Genesis chapter 39. It is actually in the back cover of your new sheet that you got on the way in also. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favour in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had, in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and after a time his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came to lie with me." And I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house. Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told him the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favour in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed.
Thanks, Dave. I think there's something disturbingly today's headlines about this passage. You cut the story one way, and it's misbehaviour of a patriarch. Allegations are made, charges are laid, mud always sticks. I mean, if it happened this way today, who would ever believe Joseph? Would you believe him? Would I believe him? Alone in the house with Mrs. Potiphar, damning evidence of male clothing strewn around the room, bruises of a struggle on Mrs. Potiphar's torso and wrists. If front page of the Telegraph, Israelite ancestor flees employer's bedroom with no trousers. And you think, Every taxi that you went in, every right-wing loony radio talkback guru that you tuned into, every dreadful current affairs show, there would be an opinion. And all of Joseph's denials would sound like Bill Clinton saying, "I did not have sex with that woman." And we would believe him about as much as we ever believed Bill. Or you cut the story the other way. Would the story break as sexual harassment in the workplace? Because that's what it is. Mrs. Potiphar makes suggestions to Joseph day after day in verse 10. She assaults him in verse 12 and removes articles of his clothing. You can imagine Joseph takes Mrs. Potiphar to court. If he does that, what are his options? She's found guilty, there is a blaze of publicity, and Joseph loses his job. Or there is not enough evidence to convict her. She is acquitted, there is a blaze of publicity, and Joseph loses his job. You know, I can see this chapter happening today, but I cannot see it working out much better now than it did in ancient Egypt. And that's a little bit disturbing. You know, do we still do the same things that they did in Egyptian times? But there's something else I find disturbing reading this as well. I mean, most likely we know the story so well. We know how it comes out. We know Joseph resists Mrs. Potiphar. We know he goes to prison. We know in the end he spells out the Pharaoh's dreams and eventually he rises to greatness. But suppose we didn't. Suppose we were reading this, hearing this story for the first time ever, without knowing anything about the story of the Bible and where the Israelites go from here. I try to read the story like that, and when I get up to the first half of verse 12, I have a problem. You think about this. Here's Joseph. He's young. He's 17, we discover in chapter 37. He's 17. He's handsome in verse 6. Handsome in form and appearance. The same words that were used of his mother Rachel before him. In fact, they're the only two people in the Old Testament who get described this way. He is single. And there is Mrs. Potiphar making advances at him. Now, in my head, that sets up a little bit like The Graduate. You know, 1968, Simon and Garfunkel music, a very, very young Dustin Hoffman playing Benjamin, and a very, very middle-aged Mrs. Robinson saying, "Come here, Benjamin." But you play it differently from that. Suppose Mrs. Potiphar is every bit as 17 as Joseph is. And she's married to the captain of the guard, who is always away on campaign. Joseph is minding the shop, and Mrs. Potiphar is there, and she is there, and she is there, and she has let him know in no uncertain terms what she wants. Now Joseph has had a rough old time. He has been dropped down a hole in the ground by his brothers. He has been sold as a slave. He has been dragged off to Egypt. He has been auctioned on the block. He is lonely. He is far from home. And here is this fragrant specimen of aristocratic Egyptian voluptuosity making suggestions to him. Think Nefertiti. Think Cleopatra at this point. It's funny, Cleopatra was 18 when Julius Caesar made her Queen of Egypt, but I've never found a picture of her that looks sort of younger than about 25, but we'll have to live with that. Just think 17. Until, in verse 12, he has her all to himself. They are alone in the house. No one will disturb them for hours, and she takes him in her arms, and his brain is fuzzed by the smell of her perfume, and his whole world is filled with her bare arms and her legs and her long black hair and her dark eyes, and her cheek is soft against his while she whispers to him exactly what she wants to do. Now, what do I expect to happen at that point? What would you expect to happen at that point? What would happen in any self-respecting movie at that point? What would happen in a book or a TV series, or for that matter in so much of what passes for real life? I tell you, I get halfway through verse 12 and I am ready. I am ready to accept whatever Joseph does. I am ready to find all sorts of excuses for him. I'm ready to find ways to let him off the hook. I'm ready to say the pressure was too much. He has held out as long as anyone could reasonably be expected to. I expect him to give in. Not just because of some weird thing called modern society or changing standards that sort of trains me to think that way. After all, we've already seen that what people get up to is not all that different now from what it was then. But if I watch movies now, or I read books written in hieroglyphics in ancient Egypt, I expect him to give in. Practically everything that I've ever learned about human beings leads me to expect to find them in bed in the next verse. So I am ready to find excuses for him. And then when he turns her away, I'm actually surprised. His behaviour seems strange to me. And I find that disturbing. More on that shortly. But what are we to do with Joseph and Mrs. Potiphar? Are we to see it as more evidence of the chauvinistic nature of the whole Christian thing? You know, this is another story about a poor innocent man who is beguiled and enticed by an amoral seductress. Should we read it like the medievals and see Mrs. Potiphar as the vehicle of temptation and lust and entrapment? Should we, in fact, use it to blame the woman? I mean, I know men who think about women that way, lascivious, sensual creatures who are out to ensnare them. But I know other men who wish women were lascivious, sensual creatures out to ensnare them. But is that what this story is all about? Or should we look at it that way, but from another angle? We say, all right, here we go. Here's another piece of the Bible's anti-woman agenda, you know, out to demean and blame women for what men do. Women are set up as all pheromones and no grey cells, and men are their hapless victims. Typical. I tell you, we may be tempted to look at it that way, except for the context. Well, what context? Well, this is chapter 39. It comes after chapter 38, that context. I mean, it's a funny thing, Joseph started in chapter 37, being thrown down a hole, sold as a slave. 37 ends with, meanwhile the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of the Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Which is pretty much where we pick up the threads in verse 1 of this chapter, isn't it? So why is there a whole chapter in between? Joseph gets sold in chapter 37. We pick up the story in chapter 39. Why is there a whole chapter in between? With the cost of ink and papyrus and that sort of thing being what it is. Chapter 38, the one that comes in between, is one of those chapters I've never heard read in church. It is very M-rated. Adult themes and sex scenes. Violence. All it needs are drug references, although we meet those in chapter 30. But chapter 38 tells the story of Joseph's big brother Judah. Now, in a way, holding off what is happening to poor Joseph for a chapter helps build the suspense we want to know. But in chapter 38, we go through a lifetime's action where dear old Judah gets married, he raises three sons, the oldest of his sons gets married to a woman called Tamar. And then the eldest son, he dies suddenly. We're told he was wicked in the sight of the Lord without any details. So by the customs that they have at the time, Tamar, his wife, gets to marry Judah's middle-sized son. And then he refuses to have children with her. He also dies. Judah promises Tamar that she can marry his third son when the third son grows up. So in the meantime, Tamar can't remarry. She goes to live with her parents. Judah does not keep his promise. He dithers around, and meantime Tamar's biological clock is ticking away. Until Judah goes off on a business trip. Tamar follows, disguises herself as a prostitute, and sleeps with her own father-in-law. Now, Genesis tells the story beautifully with plenty of detail. You will just have to read it this afternoon. But a while later, the news breaks that Tamar has had an affair and become pregnant. And with the usual double standard that we find all the way through history, Judah is offended that any daughter-in-law of his should ever do such a thing. So he demands, let her be brought out and burned. And of course she is brought out, and straight away she produces proof as good as any DNA test that Judah himself is the one who has made her pregnant. And Judah says, she is more righteous than I, for I did not give her my third son. Now the point is that Judah's story and Joseph's story go together. In Judah's case, you have the man who does the wrong thing, and in Joseph you have the woman. But put them together, and there is no way that the Bible is laying out some weird patriarchal thing that the woman is always to blame. But there's something else too. In Joseph's case, see how he resists Mrs. Potiphar in verse 8. Behold, because of me my master has no concern about anything in his house, and he has put everything he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept anything back from me except yourself, because you were his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You look at what Joseph says. He's concerned about things like honour and integrity. If he was to sleep with Mrs. Potiphar, he would be breaking obligations to Potiphar and to God, as well as misusing her. And in an odd way, Judah is on the other side of the same issue. He has made promises to Tamar, he has obligations to her that he is not keeping. So he says, she is more righteous than I. Or to put it bluntly, it is not who can I blame for my lust that is on the agenda in these two chapters. It is honour and integrity. Will I treat people according to my obligations? So is that what we should do with this chapter? Should we hold up Joseph as the very model of right behaviour and say, be like Joseph, for he's a jolly good fellow? Well, there is a bit of that, isn't there? I mean, the book of Proverbs. You read the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament, and it gives chapter after chapter to the importance of not sliding into some dishonourable relationship and breaking all my obligations. Or for that matter, the New Testament says, flee from sexual immorality. And here with Joseph, we have someone doing just that. And we see a little bit of what it looks like. Now, in a way, I need that, don't I? When every other story I see or read, or real life for that matter, tells me all the time that if I ever find myself in Joseph's position, I should just give in. When that is the case, I need this chapter to sort me out a bit. On the honour and integrity thing, when every movie that I see and every book I read and every song I hear for that matter, what my friends tell me that all gives me, says that what I feel gives me an excuse to ignore the promises that I've made. What I feel gives me a reason to walk out on my family. What I feel gives me a reason to trash some other person's obligations to her family as well, because this thing is bigger than both of us, and all that rubbish. Isn't that the way it is? I may have made promises to my wife and all that, but now Mrs. Potiphar has come along, and she loves me and I love her, and that's all that matters in the world, and Mrs. Potiphar understands me so much better than anyone else ever has. When that is what I hear all over the shop all the time, then a bit of chapter 39 going through my head doesn't go astray, does it? Stiffen my sinews and give me a bit of backbone and help me to flee from sexual immorality. I can do with this chapter for that. There's something else there that Genesis gives me, and it's to do with the way that God works in the world. See, if I'm Joseph, what does Mrs. Potiphar promise me? It's the gateway into paradise, isn't it? A life full of shared ecstasy in bed with her. But if I'm Joseph and I knock that back, what do I get? I mean, I'm doing the right thing, and surely God is in charge of the universe, and good, the good get rewarded and the wicked get punished. So if I hold out against Mrs. Potiphar's seduction, surely I should at least get some points for it. And to cap it off, I'm not just anyone, I'm Joseph. And in verse 2, the Lord is with Joseph. I am the heir of Abraham, so surely I should expect the universe to come right for me. But what happens? I do the right thing, and I wind up rotting in a prison cell, blamed for the very thing that I refused to do. Where's the justice in that? Where's God in that? Where is right and wrong in that? I might as well have slept with her and been hung for a sheep as a lamb. But that's where I really need this chapter 39. Not just to know something simple like bad things happen to people who do good. Yeah, that is not hard to work out, is it? This is the world outside Eden. Of course bad things happen to people who do good. I don't need this chapter to see that. I don't even need it to say, oh well, Joseph's setbacks are paid off later on when he becomes governor of all Egypt. I mean, we know how Joseph goes. So we know that down in verse 21, even in prison, the Lord is with Joseph. We know that eventually when Joseph faces down his brothers and he reflects on all the dreadful things that have happened to him, he speaks to his brothers in chapter 50 and says, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So we know that eventually, out of all the dreadful things that happened to Joseph, God is going to save the Israelites, and save the Egyptians, and save a pile of other people. But there's something even bigger than that going on in this story. See, the way that Joseph does the right thing, but suffers for it anyway. The way that Mrs. Potiphar works on him and works on him to break his own obligations and to break hers. The way that she uses her sexuality to manipulate someone else. The way that she lies and gets believed. If this episode is familiar now in our world, 3.5 millennia down the track, that just highlights the problem, doesn't it? Everything in the garden is not rosy. We live in a world where people manipulate each other and lie and cheat, and the wrong people get punished. I read this chapter and it needs more. And there's something else too, the other disturbing thing. Not just the way I find this chapter, but the way that it finds me. I am prepared to indulge Joseph, expecting it's all right for him to give in the end. I mean, why is it that when I read this, I think that Joseph is a bit too whiter than white? Why do I think he's a bit peculiar to knock back Mrs. Potiphar? I can say,
flee sexual immorality, but when I see Joseph doing it, why do I think that is so unusual?
Well, for that matter, why am I prepared to dismiss the Bible as just another old sexist book and look no further?
It isn't just my world that's got a problem, that it keeps repeating this Joseph episode over and over and over. It's me too. Like, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, and all that. And Joseph's staunch example of resisting temptation and going to prison isn't the answer to that. Genesis opens the wound, but it doesn't give me the answer. But it drives me on to see the answer. Joseph in prison becomes Joseph who saves Egypt and saves the Israelites. Israel in Egypt becomes Israel of the Exodus. Israel of the Exodus becomes Israel and the golden calf. The story rolls on with failure and disaster until we get to the New Testament. And then we get Jesus, who, like Joseph, doesn't give in to temptation. Unlike Mrs. Potiphar, we get Jesus, who Peter says he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. And like Joseph, Jesus is arrested and punished for something that he didn't do. And like Joseph, out of what happens to Jesus, we end up with salvation. But not just salvation for people who were suffering a drought in Egypt and roundabout. Salvation for the Josephs who give in and the Mrs. Potiphar's of this world. Salvation for people with such warped minds that they think it would be nothing for Joseph to go to bed with Mrs. Potiphar. John writes in the New Testament in 1 John that the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. The works of the devil, of which temptation and betrayal and punishment of the innocent and wrongful dismissal are all examples, aren't they? John also tells the story of Jesus forgiving the woman caught in adultery, or the Samaritan woman. Paul writes about the fresh start that we have with Jesus. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation, with the forgiveness and the new life that we have in him. Now, a world that does the sort of thing that we read here really needs that, doesn't it? Forgiveness, a new life. I need that, don't I? Everything I know about my world, everything this Joseph episode highlights for me, tells me I need that. Now, I must finish, but I can't end a look at this disturbing chapter with some nice, tidy thing that we can all take home and do. It is not like that. This is an episode to make us uneasy. It's an episode to rattle our smug ideas about making the world a better place, because so much is the same now as it was then. It's an episode to rattle our confidence in our own goodness. And like the cross, it's an episode to shake any complacency we might have about things working out fair and square here in this world. So what do I do when I read this chapter? Oh, I could sort of tut tut and say, well, how little the world has changed. I could make a hero out of Joseph and notice how God worked through him to bring salvation in the end. Or I could go further. If Joseph and Potiphar's wife set out part of the problem, the dark twists and turns of life in this world, I can follow the story on to see God's answer to that problem. In the man who stood firm against all temptation and went to the cross for the benefit of people who caved in. In the new start that he gives when he gives forgiveness. And in the hope that he holds out for the time when evil and temptation is done away with, and sad stories.